The views expressed on our programs are not necessarily those of WVON, Midway Broadcasting Corporation, or our participating sponsors.
Live from the Xfinity Studios at WVON.
We're your original social media.
You're listening to A Doctor in the House with Dr. Terry Mason on 1690, The Talk of Chicago.
Good morning. This is the show, The Doctor in the House, and your host right here every Sunday morning, Dr. Terry Mason. And this is the first Sunday of the month. And the first Sunday of the month, we always have our good friends and folks that help sponsor us, the University of Illinois Cancer Center.
Office of Vice Chancellor of Health Affairs.
And Office of Vice Chancellor of Health Affairs.
That's right.
Very good. And, of course, representing the University of Illinois and the Office of the Vice Chancellor for Health Affairs is Dr. Kareem Watson. And he's always here to talk to us about something interesting going on at my alma mater, not for undergraduate school, but for medical school, the University of Illinois College of Medicine. And we also are, I'm so delighted to have who we have on today as a guest. She is a great, first of all, a great, great person, a person that I've known for many, 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 many years. And we have done many things together, fellow Trinitarian. And by the way, happy Resurrection Sunday for those. Because don't get me started on that right now. Yeah, because right. When I start talking about that,
it's my favorite holiday. It's my favorite holiday.
You know, so so those who are celebrating Resurrection Sunday. Now, all this other stuff y'all doing, I don't know what that's about. So, but anyway, I'm going to toss it on over to you now, Dr. Watson. Good morning.
Good morning. And happy Resurrection Day or Easter to those who celebrate. I'm excited to have this conversation today about food access and diet in the African-American community. And I use the word diet, not the way that some people are thinking about diet, but use the word diet in the sense of what we eat every day, not some crash diet, not something that you start one day and stop another day, because Dr. Mason, you've taught us well to not use that term diet, but thinking about what we eat, why we eat it, and where we eat it from, and particularly how it affects the African-American community, because when we have an internationally renowned expert, Dr. Angela Odoms-Young, who's an associate professor of kinesiology and nutrition at the University of Illinois College of Applied Health Sciences. Welcome, Dr. Odoms-Young.
Thank you so much, Dr. Watson and Dr. Mason. I appreciate the invitation. It's nice also to be among friends.
Dr. Mason, you'll be proud to know that I had people like Mildred Hunter reaching out saying, make sure, Kareem, you all do something for April because April is Minority Health Awareness Month. And so they said, make sure you have conversations that are going to impact the health of the minority community. But they know you have those conversations every Sunday.
I don't get it at those times.
I would say 5 days a week, 365.
Yes, sir. Every day is the right day to talk about the right things.
And so one of the things, Angela, before we even get started, one of the things that I often say is that we're going to do a deep dive into talking about diet in African-American community, but sometimes the experts are missing. And I love to let the audience know just your expertise. So we say that you're the associate professor of kinesiology and nutrition. What is kinesiology? Because that, knowing who's doing this work and asking these research questions related to our eating habit and our health and our health environments is also important. So what is kinesiology, Dr. O?
Oh, thank you. So where we think about nutrition is being the study of nutrients or the study of diet. Kinesiology is the study of body and movement. So the complement to diet is physical activity. So on one hand, we consume, but we also have to expand. So that's a caloric balance or energy balance. So kinesiology is that other side of the equation. It's the expenditure of calories through movement and being physically active and having the body be active.
Wow. So that is something that I met a young man at Governor State we had on the show before, and he's interested in kinesiology and physical therapy and that piece. We need more and more young people of color to consider going into careers in kinesiology and nutrition, and really to understand what you bring to it, Dr. Odom Jung, is the cultural understanding, the social, cultural, environmental determinants of our diet behaviors. So, Dr. Odom Jung, tell us a little bit about your research and the work that you do, because we know that it's focused on understanding how culture, where you live, and how diet-related diseases are in low and income minority populations are impacted by even things like stress and even policy things like, you know, WIC and everything else. So can you tell us a little bit about your work?
Thank you, Dr. Watson. So my work really looks at a life course perspective. So I'm interested in infants, so breastfeeding, looking at what we call first food. So it's so important that children in our community get a healthy start, and that's through breastfeeding. So I go from everywhere from breastfeeding, so our first foods, to foods in older adulthood. So you think over the life course, because believe it or not, what happens early in life can predict your health later in life. So my first interest is what happens during that span of the entire life. The second thing that I'm really interested in is social, cultural, and environmental determinants of dietary behaviors. Years ago, we used to just think it's all choice. So you can choose either the apple or the hamburger. But we know that that's not true. You have to have supports in place. So things like structural racism play a big role. They shape what's available in our communities. They also shape the stress that people encounter. So it makes it very difficult in some cases to eat healthy when you have that constant stress. So you're living in a stressful environment with low access. Then you're also experiencing personal stress or family stress. And then we also have to have economic availability. So on one hand, we have to have availability through food assistance programs, but that really is feels the gap that society has created through lack of wealth. So that black-white wealth gap is really important, and it's something I'm particularly interested in right now. And how does closing that gap improve dietary behaviors through economic viability? So I'm interested in culture and how cultural resilience can help with diet, but I'm also interested in these external factors like structural racism or community deprivation and oppression can play a role in how and what people eat.
You know, I got a question, if I might, Dr. Watson.
Oh, of course, sir.
You know, we talk a lot about structural racism like it's a new concept, but it's not. You know, I don't even know why people even get excited about racism, because if you look at our history in America, how can you be like it's new? This is the way it has always been. This is the way the country was founded. This is the way that justified the over 400 years of what happened to us since the 1600s. So that to the side, the other question I want Dr. Odoms to ponder is we cannot let the government, the United States government and the FDA and the USDA off the hook because it was our government's intervention with creating subsidies for different companies and allowing certain foods to be subsidized more than what it cost to produce them, which was the genesis of things like high fructose corn syrup and some other things. So I really want to make sure that we do not let our government off the hook for providing the economic by subsidies and all these different programs, and Dr. Young could talk to them, even in the milk industry and so on and so forth, that make these things cheaper so that people who are in environments that don't have those resources use what limited resource they have to get what they get. But we can't blame them.
No.
We cannot blame them. We have to then put this back because our government, we just released trillions of dollars for subsidization. But what did we do for SNAP? What did we do for making more coupons available for people who can, so they can get better foods? Mm-hmm. And what do we do with the requirements that those programs will allow people to buy? So I know that's a mouthful, but Dr. Odom Jung, you know I couldn't resist it.
Definitely. And of course, Dr. Mason and I talk about this often. It's several layers to it. I think that that's so important to think about government. Because generally we think that the foods that come to the grocery store, that is just by chance. You know, there's a lot of policies in the farm bill. We've seen some policies recently to support black farmers. So who is in the marketplace becomes really important. And we have to advocate for policies that support small farmers, for example, or local production, for example. So those policies play an important role, and it's not good or bad, but it's important to just understand what role does that big P policy, what role does the farm bill play in what we eat in the United States, how we eat, how food is produced. And then if you go like one layer, what's available in your local community, how is food marketed? So there's a lot of studies that talk about or that show that unhealthy food is commonly marketed to black communities and communities of color overall, the Latinx community. So the idea that we have this overabundance of unhealthy food marketed towards our community, that plays an important role, and policy is also relevant. When it comes to that, Dr. Mason, you talked about nutrition standards. So in our federal programs, most of them have nutrition standards, and we can play a role in advocating for those nutrition standards in school lunch, nutrition standards, or what foods are available within the WIC program. So part of it is that kind of big macro policy. But then local policies also play a role in how our neighborhoods look. And you're right. Structural racism is. I'm sorry, Dr.
No. This is Kareem, and I'm happy you got to the local policies, Angela, because one of the things that I talked to a cancer survivor recently, we were talking about diet and maintaining diet and healthy lifestyle, and she told me, she said she went to the grocery store the corner store in her neighborhood. She lives on the South Side, and one banana was 99 cents. For one banana, but if she, because she went to where she could walk to, but if you go to the larger grocery store chain, you know, a pound of bananas might be 99 cents. So if she had to choose between buying that one banana for 99 cents versus a pack of ramen noodles that could, you know, she could cook for her and her grandkids throughout the week, she's going to buy that big old packet of ramen noodles for $2.99 that could last her the entire week compared to that one banana. And so I really loved the work that you did. I remember reading your reports, Dr. Odom Jung, to the Institute of Medicine on your review of the WIC food package programs, because in those reports you also talked about neighborhood access. You made it very local. Can you talk a little bit about your work to ensure that we also educate those on the corner stores and those who own the corner stores and work with them from a policy perspective?
Yes, definitely. And I first want to give a shout out, and I know I've done that before, to Iman, the Inner City Muslim Action Network, and Rage, that's doing wonderful work, and others in Inglewood, of course, across the city. We have Grow Greater Inglewood and Urban Growers Collective and the Chicago Food Policy Action Council. A lot of folks are at the table to promote policies that support those within our communities. One is corner stores. We need to make sure that we have healthy food options available. And I think it's very interesting when you talk about culture and as Dr. Mason talks about structural racism. Yeah, structural racism is not new. We know that this has come about because of the years of oppression. We talk about food deserts now, but slavery is probably the biggest, the most significant event from a historical perspective that shaped the diets of African people in the United States, so or across the African diaspora. So when we look at local policies, these policies are undoing something that occurred.
Dr. O, that was a big statement you made, though, about slavery, because many people today, especially a lot of young students are in graduate school, they will say things like, well, I wasn't there. I wasn't a part of that. I didn't condone that. So how are we continuing to see impacts of that? Can you unpack that a little bit about when you – that's a really powerful statement you made about the impact of slavery on our food systems today.
There was a very nice article in the Atlantic that talked about black land laws. And that black land laws, through policy and through policies that were not supportive of black people, created a billion, I think they estimated it at $3 billion of what that land would be worth today. So if you look at what's called extraction violence, and Dr. Watson and I work on structural violence, in the context of structural violence is extraction violence. And so extraction violence plays a big role in our food system when you talk about black land laws, other policies that created deprivation in black communities. Housing discrimination. We don't always think about the role of housing discrimination in diet, but if you don't have the wealth in your home, then that can play a role in your dietary viability. So in what your neighborhood looks like through racial segregation, we can only study differences in diet and food access because we have racial segregation. We constantly talk about the South and the West Side has less access. The South and the West Side wasn't just created by chance. It wasn't something that just occurred. It occurred through policies that created racial segregation. So it's important to think about those policies. No, people that are born right now, they did not create slavery. But if we talk about white privilege and we talk about economic privilege, that people benefit from that legacy, it's not only slavery, but it's post-slavery, that what happened with the Black Code, where blacks were incarcerated or they couldn't own land. All of those things play a role in what happens today. And so we just have to try to repair that. It's outside of the idea that, oh, it's, you know, you are to blame personally. No, you're not to blame personally, but you have benefited through white privilege and also economic privilege and the societal privilege. So how do we repair that? How do we have reconciliation, not always, you know, thinking about, oh, I didn't do this or being defensive? We know that if we create healthier environments, health and well-being among black people within society, that's going to contribute to the society overall.
And we got a quick caller before we go to break. Someone has a question for you.
All right. We want to go ahead and take Mrs. Hassan. Nia Hassan, you're on the air. Go right ahead with your question.
Yes, it's Nia Hassan. No, it's just a thank you to the doctor for recognizing the work that a man is doing in the neighborhoods there. I serve on a man's board, have been on the board for 15 years, and I'm the only board member that's in Springfield. And I don't know if you all know, but in the renovations, some of the renovations of some of our facilities that we have in the Englewood section, that we're getting ready to open up a market, a huge produce market, probably within the next couple of months. So that's something else. It would be nice sometime if you all have Dr. Rami Nashashibi, who's the executive director of Eman, to talk about some of the stuff that we've been doing with food, with the corner stores in our neighborhoods there.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, we would totally welcome that opportunity, and I'll be reaching out to you to get more information about that. I know Brother Clyde Elamine very well.
Oh yeah, I know Clyde Elamine very well.
He serves on your board too, so we will definitely connect.
Yeah,
with
Dr. Clyde Elamine is there too. Yes, so thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. One of the other things I want to say very quickly before we go to break is that we have to understand that it's one thing to change the food in the community, but we have to change the appetites in the community as well. So we'll talk about more of that when we come back after break with more of the Doctor in the House right after this. No more back thinking, time for thinking
ahead. The world has changed so very much. Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm going to keep ticking. But no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times, when we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while? Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes. And you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes. Another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger. Two if you're very overweight. And three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
It used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, 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 oh. Wake up, all the teachers, time to teach.
And we're back, and if you're just joining us, this is the Doctor in the House, heard every Sunday morning at 10 a.m. right here on AM 1690 WVON. And we're having a great conversation. Our co-host today is Dr. Kareem Watson. And we're having a great conversation with his guest, Dr. Angela Odoms Young. And Dr. Watson and I were just speaking through the break, Dr. Young, is that we need to do a proposal to talk about appetite deserts. We talk about food deserts, but it doesn't do any good if you put the right food back in the community and the people don't have the appetite for it. They won't buy it.
Yep.
And just because you know and I know it's good, if folks have never eaten beans, greens, collard greens, all that kind of stuff in their life, they won't know, one, what they are, number two, how to cook it, number three, how it tastes.
That is so true, Dr. Mason. We have a project going on, and I have to give a shout-out to our Miles Square teams. We have a project going on funded by the American Hospital Association, as well as Blue Cross Blue Shield. And we took a small cohort of our patients that are diabetic, And on Saturdays, we deliver them fresh green vegetables. And we deliver with those green vegetables, though, it's important that we deliver them recipes because we partner with Growing Home. Shout out to Growing Home in the West Englewood community. Growing Home delivers the food. They grow the food and they deliver it to our patients. And what we found out through conversations with Growing Home, they said, Kareem, we're going to also have to do some demonstrations because if the diabetic patients are a little older, they may know how to cook some of these food based on these recipes. But if they're younger patients, they more than likely may not know how to cook these foods. It may be their first time seeing an eggplant. It may be their first time seeing kale like this. They know a lot of greens, but we also have to think. So that gets to your question about appetite. And Dr. Odom-Young, how do we do more to change the appetite of people in our community so that we crave things that are going to give us the nutrients? We crave green leafy vegetables. We crave those types of carbohydrates that are good for us and not the sugary starches.
You know, one is through exposure. I think that that's really important. It's just in recent years, if you look from a historical perspective, not only in the United States, but globally, that people eat what's local to them. It's just now that you have corporate, you know, we have a international food system where things are on a global scale. So McDonald's, Coca-Cola, they're not local, they're global. So the marketing that takes place, the types of foods in the marketplace, that's very different, even honestly post-slavery. The number of SKUs in a grocery store is extensive. And so it's important that we have exposure and that we think more locally and that we think more culturally. So it's sort of, it's not unexpected, I think, as Dr. Mason mentioned, that we would lose some of our cultural diet. There was a dissertation from Norge Jerome that was done in 1969 that looked at black families that moved from the South to the North and how work patterns and just the environment overall, not being able to garden, having a different, working in a factory, just all of the different ways that life changed and how it changed the core diet. It's important that we restore that core diet and align that with culture. And I'll push back a little bit. We don't say to Italian people, you don't know what a collard green is. But people always say to us, why don't we know broccoli or why don't we know asparagus? And it's not that we can't experiment and understand these broader foods, but the first step to getting people to eat healthy is restoration of the cultural diet. And you're seeing that a lot in indigenous communities. They're not looking outside. They're restoring their cultural diet.
I'm so happy you said
that. And they're doing that. Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm happy you said that. And thank you for pushing back because you're absolutely right. And so to clarify the point I was making earlier, some of the conversation we want to make is to make sure that the diets that we're doing are culturally appropriate. Because even when we think about these, the crazy, there's several articles out there right now about the Mediterranean diet and the impact of the Mediterranean diet, which we know is more associated with foods that are affiliated with Greece and South Italy and other parts of the world. Are beneficial to, you know, keep us healthy and our immune system healthy for COVID-19. But where's the discussion on the Southern diet or diets equivalent to people of, you know, from West India and other populations and how those foods, the healthier versions, may be helpful to boost our immune system?
Not things. Just there, but we have a lot of I don't want to call them diets. Because I want to call them the way people
eat. It's the literature. You're absolutely right. But
we need to call what these eating programs. And there's some literature now looking at, I was just looking at a study on colon cancer, looking at so-called Africans mm-hmm. on the so-called African continent that eat a so-called traditional African diet having a much lower rate of colon cancer because of one of the things, much more fiber.
Mm-hmm.
So more beans and more whatever the local, to Dr. Angela Odom's point, the more local vegetation that grows in these areas. And we have to remember, it was us who brought okra to the United States. Okra has been around for over 12,000 years. It was us who brought red beans and who brought legumes into the dietary pattern, because we brought those things with us. And we have to remember that we were already here before the slave trade. So we were already trading some of these things before the slave trade. So we have to reorient and refocus and not give all of the credence to folks that don't look like us. Want to go to the phones and get Maurice. Maurice, you're on the line. Go right ahead.
What you're overlooking is that cooking is really generational, right? And so just no judgment.
No, we're not overlooking it, Maurice. We're not overlooking it. I just want to be clear.
You know, but we no just, judgment, empirical right. information, right?
Okay.
Statistically, my parents are from the South, married 60 years. My mother made a meal. They weren't wealthy. Made a meal every single day because she was married and she had time. Statistically, now African-Americans are more single parents. If you're a single parent, you don't have time to make a healthy meal. I'm from the west side of Chicago. You know what you're doing? You're pulling in through that drive-thru. You're going down, we call them greasy spoons when I was a kid. You're going to the greasy spoon restaurant. You know, it's a good concept, but the family dynamic just doesn't allow it sometimes. You know, sometimes these households, there's no one else. There may be just a household of single women raising kids by themselves, where you have a lot of younger people and with no generational information passed down on how to make a healthy meal.
Well, thank you, Maurice, for that. Dr. Odoms, you want to respond?
Yeah, Maurice, I think that's a very good point. It's important that we think of, from a community standpoint, not an individual standpoint. We, a lot of times, put pressure on those that are experiencing the most disadvantage and just say, okay, well, we want you to come home and we want you to cook some dried beans. And, you know, it is very important that people get beans, but it's not necessarily important that they cook them. And before, we lived in commonly multi-generational communities. I even think about growing up, I stayed with my grandmother when my mother was at work. And my grandmother, it's my grandmother, honestly, that taught me how to cook. My great aunt that taught me how to cook, how to make bread and how to, I mean, of course, we cooked a lot of Southern food, and I would see my grandmother cooking a lot of Southern food. And we had vegetables every day. My grandmother played a big role in that. It wasn't just my mother. It wasn't just my aunt. And so it's important we think about it from a community standpoint, that we figure out models to work together and support each other and not necessarily put so much pressure on each other to say, okay, you're a single mother. I want you to come home and you got to cook from scratch. And no, we need to work together as a community and as neighbors. As Dr. Mason, many times when we talk about he talks about how he grew up in Inglewood and just the support that people had for each other. And that's very important that we teach people and we support people. But that's a community focus. How do we work together as a community? How do we start businesses in the Black community? You know, even if we, I'm not saying the food was just super healthy, but a meal on a plate, not a drive-through. In the 80s, in the 70s, a lot of Black-owned restaurants were on the South and the West Side. A lot of those restaurants are gone. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't have a healthier twist, but instead of having a drive-through McDonald's, why don't we have where you could get drive-through okra? Yep. Drive-through black beans, you know. So part of it is, how do we create that community in, you know, 2020 and not just say, okay, well, you're a single mom, you need to do it. To your point, people are struggling. It's like, you know, and then we're like, okay, come home and cook and do this. And I mean, I even look at, I'm you said Dr. Odom Young. I live on the South Side. I've been at home because of COVID, and it makes it very difficult for families to do that. And so it's so important that we work together to create more resilient communities and families through cooperative relationships and economic development through cultural businesses.
Well, we're going to have a conversation on that. I'm going to have Mark come in. We're going to talk a lot about businesses because we've lost more businesses in the last 30 years than we've created from one point of view. I want to go to the phones and get Akilah. Akilah, you're on the air. Go right in with your question for Dr. Odom Young.
Dr. Terry Mason, sir, thank you so much. You know something? The spirit jumped in me when you opened today, and the shout that came out of my mouth based on what you said and the way I heard it was amen. So amen to you, amen to your co-host, and a woman amen to your guest.
That's right. We got to say we got to say a woman. If we're going to say amen, we got to say
right.
a woman.
That's right. And so what I am referencing is similar to it is written that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of his mouth. And that is found in Matthew 4:4 and Luke 4:4 and Deuteronomy 8:3 in the biblical scriptures. And so when I listen to you, Dr. Mason, and your guests and your co-host, I agree 100%. That's why I had to say amen 3 times, because we cannot let the government from the top down get off with easy charges. White people are just as sick, if not worse, to some degree, for what they have done, knowing that they are continuing to perpetrate the wrongs to the least of these. And God is still angry, in my estimation, in my spirit, about it. So I commend you and your show. May God continue to bless you, especially on this passionate resurrection, end of Daniel fast and beginning Ramadan 2021. Okay?
Thank you so much, Sister Keela. Appreciate you.
And Dr. Angela, I don't know if you were on the Cancer Center's talk last week when they had Dr. Lewis Cantley from the Cornell Cancer Center, the Weill Cornell Cancer Center. And one of the things he talked about that was so interesting was that he's a cancer researcher, Dr. Mason, who looks at the impact of sugar on cancer. And he's done some mouse models, Dr. Mason, where he's shown that exposing mice to high fructose and high glucose, if they are injected with these certain types of polyps, that those polyps will turn into different, you know, going from normal polyp to a cancerous polyp just by adding the sugar and glucose, fructose and sucrose, which what we know. But one of the things that I love that he did, which I hope a lot of researchers are doing this, is thinking about how can we turn what we do from a research perspective into economic engines and businesses for black and brown communities, so that he's developed a diet plan, a food plan, an eating plan. We call them diets. We got to move away from that, Dr. Mason. I know, but he developed a food eating program that he delivers to cancer patients that's based on a healthy, green, leafy, organic diet plan. And his goal is to get the insurance companies to help pay for that. Now, this is a plan that he develops. This is going to turn into a small business. And people don't even know about these things called SBIR, Small Business Innovative Research Grants. These are from the federal government that can take your research idea and turn it into a small business idea. So these are the conversations on why we need more Dr. Odom Young out there, because we need to take her idea for a drive-through okra, black bean, and fast food drive-up that's healthy. We need to turn that into a small business innovative research idea, Dr. Odom Young.
I couldn't agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that we need to move with haste.
Yes.
And I think the other thing I cannot leave off the table is insulin growth factor 1.
IGF-R.
IGF, that's right. And that's found in milk,
yes,
cow milk. And we have to tell the truth about the role that cow milk plays, particularly in those people who are either at risk for or have diagnosed malignancies. Dr. Young.
Now, Dr. Mason always puts me on the spot with this. That, you know, we have, it becomes difficult about evidence. And I think Dr. Watson made a really good point, because what we need to do, and this is why we need more scientists of color, what gets studied gets adopted.
That's
you
right.
Can't really have nutrition standards need evidence. We need to have evidence. And it's important that we have people bring new ideas about what questions to ask and how different diets work with different conditions. And I think sugar is a good example of that, because years ago, people used to talk about fat. And some of that was guided by industry. And so it's so good to have scientists at the table. There's a good article about how fat became demonized in the academic literature, and how sugar before was not acknowledged as playing a role in heart disease or cancer. So we see a lot about sugar right now. So we need to be, it's very important to look at producing evidence. And I think the second thing
is, I would go beyond producing evidence, because as Dr. Mace would often say, the evidence is there, but sometimes it's producing evidence and also getting that evidence in front of the right people and making it speak their language. Because one of the things I love about, you know, we, Angela, I know you and I both have been part of Society of Behavioral Medicine. They actually take us, Dr. Mason, they teach us how to turn our research into a policy brief. And they teach us how to take those policy briefs to legislators with one page briefs and talk about what we found through our evidence and why what they vote on the Hill should align with what we found out in our research. We need to do more of that, to take all the evidence that people like Dr. Odoms Young and others are doing to make sure it gets in front of legislators.
Well, you know, Maddie Hunter has sponsored a bill now that says that anytime children are offered these packs, these food, you know, these little Happy Meal sort of things. And I shouldn't say that word, because I don't want to tie it to anybody. But that they have to have a different beverage associated with that. They can get water, but that needs to be part of the package. Not only the sugar sweetened beverage, but water or something else needs to be in there. So I want to give that shout out to Maddie Hunter and State Senator Maddie Hunter for what she's doing. And I think that there is a lot that's already out there, but we cannot ignore the impact that industry has on making sure, because they are putting the real M money behind making sure they change the small P policy. And we can't separate those things, because just because something is right and evidence-based, because even what I just spoke about IGF-1 is evidence-based. Now, the question is, do I want to believe that evidence? And if I'm in a position just like the tobacco company, and I'll stop here, the tobacco company knew 50 years before it was forced to admit that cigarette smoking caused lung cancer, when they already had the science. So we have the science. We don't have the economic and the will to go up against major food. That's the problem.
Yeah, and I want to mention something else related to that, and it's really important. I was just reflecting on this idea about nutrients and foods. And so when we look at kind of a food hierarchy, part of it is you can get certain nutrients from many different foods. One area where we have a gap in sort of a historical gap in nutritional sciences research, early on, particularly in the indigenous community, there was more work in thinking about how a combination of different foods within traditional diets create nutritional adequacy. And so part of thinking now, that work is really important, because if we look at certain nutrients, we need certain nutrients, and that's been science since, you know, for years and years, that we need certain nutrients to live, that there are certain nutrients that are healthy, that create healthier outcomes. And there are certain food components like sugar that create poor outcomes. We've had in sugar-free beverage research, et cetera. But I think when it comes to those nutrients, many times we think about foods that are commonly consumed in the United States. And even the dietary guidelines talks about alternatives to deliver those nutrients. But that's very important when we look at the cultural diets, because we have to look at foods that provide nutrients and that those alternatives are there. And I'll give an example about the WIC food package. There was a committee, the National Academy of Sciences committee, that recommended an updated WIC food package. And the National WIC Association is advocating for that food package. And in that food package is flexibility and choice. So you don't have to choose a certain type of whole grain. You can look at there's a recommendation that the food package provides some flexibility. So if you want to get chaff or you want to get buckwheat, that the programs have enough flexibility. That's important because diets are different. We don't always think about the African-American diet being a certain way, or we may think about certain diets, you know, people that are from another country, that their diets are so different. But what we need to do is we need to have some flexibility where people can choose different foods to meet their nutrient requirements. And you might choose food A, somebody else might choose food B. So look, I would just encourage your listeners to take a look at some of those new policies that would expand fruit and vegetables in the WIC food package, that would look at diversity of whole grains in the WIC food package. I think the other thing is like the cash types of food assistance, like pandemic EBT that's happening right now, mm-hmm. to help support those that would normally be in school that would get school lunch. Pandemic EBT, things like SNAP, those, that's a cash benefit. If we have enough adequacy in that cash benefit for people to choose nutritional foods, then we have, and we're seeing that with the pandemic EBT, that children in CPS are able to get access to that pandemic EBT and help support families. Because when you have a family, and I don't want to go on and on about this, but when you have a household that's economically secure, because food insecurity is associated with dietary quality, we need households that are more economically secure to be able to choose those foods that provide adequate nutrients, and then also to be able to have flexibility and choice within federal programs so people can eat a diversity of foods that meet their cultural diets. So part of it is really not always prescribing, but giving some flexibility. And then if we change environments, we change the mindsets and support families, then it becomes a package, a combination that helps people eat healthier as well as have you know, better mental health and well-being.
Great point, Dr. Odoms, Angela Odoms Young. I think it's great that we do that. We did that with the program we did, RX for Health, for mm-hmm. Cook County people, where we gave
that. And we're adopting that.
Yeah, where we had people get fruits and vegetables prescribed, even even tailored to their disease, whether it was diabetes or if they had renal failure. Let's take this one last caller very, very quickly, because we're down to our last couple of minutes. So we're going to take, or maybe we won't take this last caller left. Dr. Angela Odoms, we're down to the last 2 minutes. And, you know, it's always my delight. You know, I love you like a country hog does Tom Slop. So, and that's a lot of love.
That's a lot of love.
The feeling is mutual.
Yeah, and we got, and I want, we got to get together again because I got some other stuff I want to run by you. But I want to give you these last, Dr. Watson, we have like a minute and a half left.
So do you have a question, a caller?
Nope. Oh. We won't be able to take it now anyway.
So, Dr. O, one of the things we want to, one of the things we want to make sure is that we let our listeners know that if they need a primary medical home and to learn more questions about our work at Miles Square, they can reach us at 312-996-2000. Again, that's 312-996-2000. Anything you would like to leave our listeners with today?
I think policy. So we need to advocate for policies. We need to support. So policies that help support communities. So we need to advocate for policies. We need to advocate for policies that support communities. But we also have to work together to support people within our communities, through our churches. I didn't get a chance to mention Imani Village. Of course, that's a project that to create a planned community on the south side that's led Trinity. But the idea is that policies that support communities and people that support each other within communities. And so we have to push economic development out to communities. We have to
Well, Dr. Odom Jones, we got your point. We got your point, and
like
we got to
report. 2 minutes, so sorry.
No, not 2 minutes. Yeah. You got 10 seconds now. So I want to thank all of you for listening. Thank you very much, Dr. Angela Odom Jones, for being our host, our guest today, Dr. Kareem Watson, for being our co-host. That next voice you're going to hear is that of Pam Morris Walton, who's coming to make a joyful noise over the radio. And until next week, at the same time and station, may God continue to bless each and every one of you with continued health and strength as I leave you now in peace.
Under my existence, what's my purpose for residing?